Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to the Global Political Uncertainties podcast. I'm the host, Richard Benulli, and also a consulting partner for Cedar Portfolio. Today, we're doing a live discussion with interested audience participants, together with our consulting partners, Art Berman and Ira Harris. Art has 40 years of experience as a petroleum geologist. His work focuses on unfiltered data-backed takes on energy and its colossal role in the world's economic pulse. Ira is a past hedge fund manager and a current global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Today, we want to do a focus podcast to explain our risk management process and approach methodology on how we assess and mitigate geopolitical risks in the economy, in businesses, and in the financial markets. We provide consulting services which can work with you and for your firm in this space. Our format today is we'll go through our process with elaboration from us and then later answer some questions posed by our interested audience participants. I'm just going to share my screen. If everybody can see my screen. Global political uncertainties risk is our focus today. And we have our contact email address here, info@cedarportfolio.com, in case anybody would like to contact us. This is a bit on our background. And maybe we can do a round table on this. Art, did you want to give some elaboration on your background?
Sure, Richard. I'm a petroleum geologist. I've worked in all areas of energy for the last 45 years. I've got a degree in Middle Eastern history, so I'm not an expert, but I know more than some. Geopolitics, how that relates to energy, economics, human behavior, and the environment is really my specialty.
Great. Thanks, Art. And Ira?
Yeah, I'm just, I've been a trader, active trader, still an active trader. I've been previously managed hedge funds over several decades in and out. Been involved in the CME and bringing it forward into the electronic age. I was very involved with that. So, and still actively trading. I'm a global trader. I trade commodities. My real strength is foreign currencies and the debt markets, but everything. I'm not a great stock picker from the bottom up, but I look more forward to looking at an overall view and then trying to find some equities that'll fit that overall view and with a really strength on political economy.
Great. Thanks, Ira, and myself. Richard, I do the podcast together on the FRA, Financial Repression Authority, Roundtable Insight Cast Program Show with Ira. We interview and talk with some of the best economists, fund managers, and industry gurus around the world. Myself, on my background, I've held senior management positions with KPMG and Manulife. I'm the founder and CEO of Cedar Gold, as well as the Cedar Portfolio, an initiative we have for a model portfolio. And I've done extensive work on risk management in market risk, credit risk, and operational risk. So we just wanted to introduce our process. This slide here gives a high-level view, and we can go into an example on energy later, but just for introduction, this is the process we have where we initially look at the pain points, identify what that is, that moves as part of this fishbone diagram into an assessment phase where we assess those pain points. Then that identifies opportunities, that could be opportunities in business areas or in the financial markets. And then associated with these opportunities, there are risks entailed to which we then develop mitigation strategy. So in the risk world, you can either accept the risk or do something about it in terms of a mitigation strategy. And the third thing you can do is transfer the risk typically to like an insurance company. It could be some written off risk. So three ways to approach risks. We'll focus on the mitigation risk approach. And the overall framework that we have is based on this view where there are a number of policies and tool areas and categories that we look at, we identify, and those are looking at capital, trade, political, monetary, fiscal, industrial, and economic areas that relate to policies and tools. And then to the right of that are actual specific examples of what we would be looking for, you know, in terms of like capital, identifying if there's either areas where potential for capital freezing, confiscation of assets, expropriations, nationalizations of mining companies, for example, as well as investment regulations, restrictions, and maybe changes to registered accounts like 401ks or RSPs. We also look at trade areas that may involve what's happening now, especially today in tariffs, sanctions, boycotts, subsidies by governments, and foreign loans, how that's handled. There's also free trade agreements that could be in the multipolar world, you know, so free trade agreements within particular polar areas, polar jurisdictions in a multipolar world. Political means like looking at political relations, regional conflicts, wars that could be presenting risks to businesses in the financial markets. And then we have monetary issues. So that could be interest rate settings, controls, maybe yield curve control has been instituted as a policy. You also have currency controls or methods like quantitative easing, QE, quantitative tightening, QT. Fiscal industrial has to do with either stimulus programs by governments or application of subsidies, tax incentives. And the finally is the economic that is more on in more of the traditional setting inflation policy or identifying what can be done in unemployment for tools, controls. So the trend is more in the upper layers. And what we've seen recently is more on the economic layer, but now we're moving into these upper layers in terms of risks. So that's the overall framework. Our program, FRA Roundtable Insight, is based on a theme that we have seen since we started the program show back in 2014, and that's on financial oppression. So this is a chart that explains what that is and how there are four spokes of four areas generally of financial repression in terms of pillars that we look at. So what we're seeing now is essentially financial repression on steroids in the current environment. Okay, so I just wanted to move into the next slide, which will present, it'll have a discussion with Art and Ira. And so this is applying our process to the energy area as a focus. So Art, did you want to speak to this from your perspective?
Well, sure, Richard. My perspective is simply that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about exactly what those issues that you described really are. There's so much emotional reaction right now to tariffs, and particularly I think a lot of people are having a hard time letting go of the way that they've always thought about things, kind of their precious models of how the world works. And so I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying that in order to have impact on business, we have to get beyond these, wishing things were different than they are, hanging on to old ways of doing things, and focus on the real world and what the factors are that affect our lives and our well-being and our businesses. And you've described the outcomes and the symptoms. What I think that we can provide here is getting down to where do those symptoms and outcomes come from, and what can you do about them, your business or consultants?
Great. And in terms of this process flow, could you lead the audience into insights into how the risk management happens for approach and methodology, like in terms of looking at pain points, assessment phase, opportunity phase, risk and mitigation phases? With regards to an emphasis on energy from your perspective?
Sure. So when it comes to pain points, I mean, I want our clients to tell us what their pain is. I mean, we can't know that. So you tell us what your pain is, and we'll try to help you identify what's causing that pain. We're not physicians, but in some ways, that's the first thing we do. We take a history. You tell us what's going on, what's bothering you, what's hurting you. And once we understand that, then we can go through the flow that we've established to try to help you feel better and eventually get down to the root cause. But I think so much of the global conversation is fundamentally what I call energy blind. And that means that people think about, and when I talk about people, I'm talking about experts, talking about political leaders, economists, leading opinion and thought leaders, you name it. And energy to them is kind of just another factor. It's like politics. It's like social media. It's something else we talk about. And what I think is lost on so many people is that energy is the economy. I mean, an economy is really nothing more than work. And where does work come from? It comes from energy. I mean, in the most basic human way, if you haven't eaten enough food, you got no energy. If your economy hasn't eaten enough oil, natural gas, coal, renewables, whatever, it can't function. So there's a paradigm change that seems so obvious, but apparently it's not, which is at the root of all of the pain that people feel economically, financially, is energy. And we've been somehow conditioned to think that it's all economic and financial. It's about rates, it's about markets, and of course those are important, but underlying those is always energy. So that's what I bring to the table. Richard and Ira have much more diverse backgrounds in aspects of capital and markets and monetary policy and all of that. But, you know, I'm the annoying person in the corner that says, yeah, but what about energy? Because if you're not talking about energy, you're missing the elephant.
Great. Thanks, Art. And Ira takes more of a perspective on investing in equities of energy businesses. So this is another angle that we could bring to the table in terms of risk management services. So Ira, did you want to discuss on your perspective with regards to how we could approach this, or what are the factors that need to be considered when assessing the risks, geopolitical risks, global political uncertainties in investing in equities of energy businesses?
Well, you know, not just equities, but if we look, yesterday was actually, a great introduction to this, because you saw what happened in Spain and Portugal, especially Spain, and the fallout from that. Now, you may say, well, it's just going to be an energy fallout, and Art would look at that, and there's a lot to that. But now we're going to look at it because if this was an issue that the whole grid in Spain, of course, was affected by the failure of enough backup capacity to sustain the baseloads, then it's going to bleed into the overall picture of the EU, because so much emphasis has been put on the quote-unquote, I hate the phrase, but we don't have anything better than the Green Initiative. And if they have to build out further things along with the huge amount of money that they've directed towards the Green Initiative, then it's going to affect bond prices. And we know that Europe is on an infrastructure build. So this does play all into it. And will it be a positive? Yeah, it will probably be a positive as a face up to the realities of what's going to have to be done. So we'll be looking at things that stem out of there. But it will affect certainly the bond markets. And I'm keeping my eyes very closely attuned now to see how that is and how the market's going to affect that. They've already looked, you know, we've seen a backup. We've seen the yields in Europe rise in anticipation of the coming massive infrastructure spend and fiscal stimulus. So this is, you know, how I will look at it and see what types of opportunities do avail themselves from this. But of course, you know, then it, as much as others, will they go, where will nuclear fall into this, especially with the French input? Of course, we know about the LNG movements. So there's going to be a lot of discussion about where this goes and importantly, how it's going to affect the entire financial overlay of the EU.
Great, Ira, thanks, Finn. So yeah, what we're looking at here is the idea of when we do risk management, we could look at it from a top-down perspective or a bottom-up perspective, either of those two services. If there's a, like an investment portfolio of identified assets, then we could do assessment of those, identifying what the risks are, and what the mitigations could be based on those risks, or a top-down in terms of what asset classes make sense in this environment, given the geopolitical risks. So either way, we're able to do either of those two types of services.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to add to what you just put in there, Richard, is for any of you who might hope that what we're going through right now is somehow going to get better if what we have is bad, or that it's going to go back to the way it was, then we're probably not the right people for you to talk to. I think my perspective is things may never be better in the next 5 years than they are right now. And if that doesn't define risk, well, I don't know what does. And so the perspective that we take, again, is not pessimistic by any means. It's realistic. And the reality is that we're living in a world in which the old way of doing business is collapsing and disintegrating. And if things are ever going to get better, it's not going to be until all of that falls out and restructures, and that's not going to be anytime soon. So that's a starting point for a conversation that if you're waiting for things to get better, then we're the wrong people to talk to, because we don't think in terms of better or worse. But if you don't like what's going on right now, then you really need to talk to us, because that is not going to change very much in the, when I say near to medium term, I'm talking about several years, maybe decades. So that's what we do. That's what we enjoy doing, is helping people find ways to understand and therefore get around their pain.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Art. And maybe we can move to questions at this time. So there was a question here from Bert. He asked, Art, in a recent podcast, you made a point about the Russians being militarily backward and thus the reason they are not winning in the Ukraine. I have been following the Russia-Ukraine-U.S. conflict for years now and am of the opinion, which is shared by experts, that assertion is almost entirely incorrect. How did you arrive at Russia as losing the war? Honestly, it sounds like U.S. State Department propaganda. That's Bert's question. Your thoughts, Ira? Art. Yeah, for Art.
Yeah, well, I didn't say Russia was losing the war. What I said was that in 2 years, they've been completely ineffective at fighting a tenth-rate global military power. And whatever you think about Russia, the U.S., and that's not a partisan statement, by the way. My ancestors come from Russia, so I'm not against Russia, and nor am I pro-U.S. State Department. What I'm saying is that if you can't beat a country that doesn't even have an air force, then you're probably not an awesome military power. That's the pure objective analysis. And so much of what drives global decisions, whether it's political, financial, or economic, is based on perception. And if your perception is that Russia is about to invade the rest of Europe because they're an awesome military power, then again, you're talking to the wrong group of people. We don't dismiss Russia as a danger, a threat, geopolitically. But my opinion is they can't even get beyond two or three oblasts in eastern Ukraine. How do we jump from that to they're about to take over Europe? I mean, it's just, you know, again, it's not a preference. It's not an opinion. It's based solely on reality, on objective observation. So if you're caught up in the emotional argument about whether Russia is something or something else, then you're not focusing on the geopolitical reality of what we need to deal with. And I'm not dismissing your opinion. I'm not saying it's a legitimate opinion. The other thing I'll say is that just because experts say it doesn't mean that it's right. I mean, I follow, Ira follows, Richard follows, everything just about that's written about our respective topics. And I'd say that 99% of it is echo chamber stuff. You know, it's somebody says what somebody said the day before. And there may well be truth to it, but what you're looking for, I think, is insight. You know, not analyst on repeat. You can get that without paying any money for it. You can just read the paper.
Good points, Artin. There was some general questions as well, a collection of questions surrounding the U.S. tariffs and trade war ongoing. Maybe that would be a good question for Ira. Your thoughts, Ira, on how that affects global political uncertainties in the financial markets?
I don't have to be, I could be on the View and give the, I mean, it, of course, it's caused hypersensitivity, and that's what I would phrase, to the global geopolitical as well as the financial. And yet, you know, if you read different aspects of it, if you read Michael Pettis, you'll come away with a different view. And I think that's important because everybody wants to go back and look at this through the eyes of Smoot-Hawley. And I've actually been doing a lot of reading as what went on, and as Smoot-Hawley, you know, even though proposed in 1929, it took quite a while. And again, this is where a lot of my graduate school education discusses, but you see it through new lights because we haven't looked at this. Interestingly, is that Smoot-Hawley really began as an agricultural issue. And that's how I would look at it. You know, I'm almost prone to this. And, you know, I've been very critical of Peter Navarro when I was blogging regularly. I'm not blogging now, but in 2018, it was pure stupidity in the way that they handled this. And why? Because I looked at it. If you're going to put on tariffs, and that's what they went for in 2018, when did he do it? March of 2018, right into the Brazilian harvest. And I was talking about that. So you weren't going to make China's life difficult because there was an alternative source. And Brazil had a record harvest at the time. So there was an alternative to buying U.S. grain, which China had been doing and which the United States Department of Agriculture had been really pushing for American ag exports to China. That was one of the big things. That had been a big issue going back to the 1950s when China was really starving and coming on out of the revolution. So for years, they've been trying to do this. And because of the ill-timed and stupidity of it, and it was stupid, they just pushed China to turn to Brazil, and Brazil has met it. And who has suffered? The U.S. ag sector. And this is where we're seeing the tariffs, and then the tariffs become stupid, in my mind, for so many different reasons. But in the geopolitical sense, where's China? China's back to Brazil. Now, interestingly, when Scott Bessent was giving his confirmation hearing, talked about reinstituting and pushing for the original 2018 agreement with China, which we're not getting at all because there's just so much noise and there's so much, and the noise creates chaos. And again, and here they are, you lose your credibility. And that's where I think the bond markets have really taken a hit. You lose your credibility. You cannot be a deficit cutter when your first response is how to react to the tariffs effect on U.S. farmers, that all of a sudden you're going to do a subsidization program of maybe $30 billion to bail out the U.S. ag sector. No. You can't go that route. If you're a deficit cutter, and I am a deficit, I come out of the Austrian school, and it's prominently deficits, you lose all your credibility if that's your response. So my response was, well, if we're going to do these tariffs, and again, there's no systematic approach. Why? Because everybody who jumps in there, That's like 1930, because what started out in the ag became totally industrial. So we're not far along enough in this tariffs to see who's really going to be directing it here. And when I say directing it, I'm not talking about President Trump or anybody in the White House. I'm talking about who's going to glom onto it and try to find that there's something positive for them and push it from that perspective. So the tariffs are, I understand that you want to disrupt the whole concept of Trump and others, was that they wanted to disrupt what was the status quo, because the status quo was only working for a few and not for the majority. So they want to get to that. But it's so slipshod and paces together. You need to have a greater structure as to how you're going to approach it. And to talk about it is fine. And as other people have brought, it's not the trade numbers per se, it's the current account. And with the way that you're approaching this, you're not going to help your current account deficit situation anyway. So those are the ways that I look at it. And just jumping on the tariffs, to me, as Art so beautifully said, we'll take you away from the hysteria. Anybody can get a hysteria, and there's hysteria all over it, and especially the mainstream media. So we try to take our knowledge based on where we've been and what we've done. And it's not only academic knowledge, it's practical knowledge. It is the pure concept of praxis, in which we try to take what is theoretical and make it practical, so that if it's not operative to make a profitable return, then we failed, because that's ultimately what it's about. It's not to sit here and pontificate.
Great, thanks, Ira. And Charles Hugh Smith has a question relating to destabilizing forces geopolitically in the status quo. Charles, did you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thank you. This question is a bit maybe high level, but I'd like to hear what Ira and Art see as potential risk factors relating to the idea that growth for growth's sake, which has kind of been the paradigm that's been active for decades, if that's ending because we're no longer able to support just growth for growth's sake, that we're going to have to target growth and maybe change our priorities, or and how each nation is that's attempting to continue that policy of growth for growth's sake, like throwing money just to keep consumption high, et cetera, et cetera. If that end of the sort of Keynesian model where growth for growth's sake isn't going to work anymore, what kind of risks could arise from that?
Yeah, that's a really perceptive question, Charles. And I think that the first way to start framing the question is, why is what's going on in the world right now with the fragmentation of the global and political order going on? It's a zero-sum game, okay? And zero-sum means if I grow, somebody else doesn't grow. So there is implicit in everything that's going on right now, whether they say it or even understand it, there is implicit a recognition that growth as we have known it, certainly for the last 75 years, is over. Okay? Bottom line, that if I want to grow, that means somebody else has to shrink. And so when Ira talks about going back to Smoot-Hawley in the 1930s, I want to remind everybody that the zero-sum mercantile approach is how the world operated from the beginning of really the end of the Renaissance until World War II. So what has been normal since the end of World War II does not at all reflect the way that the world operated before then. And tariffs, and I'm totally with Ira that so much of what this administration does, it bungles not because the ideas are bad, but because it just bungles the way it does things. That's not a political statement. Tariffs were part and parcel of what made the United States a strong country. I mean, we've had tariffs since Alexander Hamilton. There's nothing new about that. And so tariffs only seemed like a departure because we've been moving in the opposite direction, certainly for the last 40 or 50 years, if not 75. So there's nothing revolutionary about tariffs or a mercantile or a zero-sum approach. But to your question, Charles, growth is very much an issue that is central to this, and there is not sufficient opportunity for everyone to grow. And that's why we're dividing the world into camps. We're fragmenting into Team A and Team B and Team C because somebody's got to win. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's, you know, that's kind of the rules of the game that we're playing right now. And that goes back to, you know, we can have philosophical arguments about whether tariffs good or bad or indifferent, but you know, nobody that I know of on this call is getting regular text messages from the president of this country or another country asking whether you think tariffs are a good idea. these things are in motion, and they're all going to happen whether we think they're a good idea or not. So, you know, let's stop arguing about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea and start talking about, you know, what do we do as individuals and groups to safeguard our wealth and to try to maintain what we have. I mean, that's really what we're here to talk about, isn't it? But yeah, Charles, I mean, I think that's absolutely the right question to ask. And the answer is growth as we know it will be fundamentally different from this moment forward and probably has been fundamentally different, at least since 2008 and probably before that.
Thanks, Art. And related to this question, Soren, you wanted to ask a question on trade between U.S. and China?
Yeah, thank you. I would like to ask if you see there will be a complete stop of trading between U.S. China, and what do you see like follow-on risks to that in form of lower growth, trade wars, even escalating into real wars?
Want to take it, Ira?
Sure. So, you know, sorry, that's of course a great question. They've been asking this question since 1971, right? You know, it's everybody throws out this Taiwan issue. But if you go back to 71, 72, when Nixon and Kissinger were opening up China, whatever that means, the discussion was, and Taiwan, the United States would never risk a thermonuclear war to keep Taiwan independent. And that was the basis of them sitting down and going, okay, and you see the way that the U.S. played with that, right? And then by 1979, you get the concept of strategic ambiguity because they didn't want Taiwan. You know, Taiwan was led by not necessarily the best of people, Chiang Kai-shek and his wife, who knew how to manipulate the world scene pretty well. Would the United States, you know, I expect truly to wake up one day and see that the Chinese Navy has quarantined Taiwan, almost like the U.S. Navy did to Cuba in 1962. Now, what do you do? A quarantine is more an action to say, here, I'm sending you a statement. How far do you want to go with this? So that would not shock me. Where they go, first of all, Europe can't cut off China. Germany is so tied into China with so much foreign direct investment, as the Japanese are. So everybody's pushing pretty hard here. You know, I remember that story when in the FT years ago when the Chinese bought ThyssenKrupp, the factory, dismantled it, and just took it right back on boats back to China, a giant factory. And Germany, from that time, they're very intertwined. Right now, Germany's suffering because they're trying to figure out where they're going to go with this. But the world is also intertwined with China. And China's not. See, the problem with the United States policy, and I'll be critical of it for 50 years, they think that everybody's going to sit there as their models are static, that everybody's response is going to be static. No. And we saw that with Russia in 2022, when Dalip Singh, came up with these sanctions. Everybody said, aren't these sanctions great? I said, well, let's see what the response is. And the Russians just didn't sit there and say, slap me. They started looking to see what alternatives. So all of a sudden they're shipping India, discounted oil, but India is buying all the Russian oil it can, refinery, and shipping it. And why wouldn't they? You're going to do, you're a democratically elected government, and you're going to do what's good for your people. And others have done that. And China is very aggressive in what we now call the global south. We used to call the third world. So they're moving, and there's all these other avenues, like again, in Latin America. And what does the United States go back and fall on the Monroe Doctrine? Well, things have changed dramatically. So, and that's the problem with all the noise that comes out of this group. And again, I'm with Art. This is not a political statement. This is reality. And just because you think this doesn't mean it's going to happen. That's my problem with Navarro. Navarro is totally linear in the way that he thinks that if we do this, this is going to be the outcome. Well, my job is to sift through all that and say, this isn't going to be the outcome. And what are the potentials for other types of outcomes that you didn't plan for? And again, COVID was a classic case. Everybody said, well, the world's going to collapse. We're going to go into a total deflationary spiral. Well, yeah, you started down that path. And of course, the central banks of the world flooded it with money. But then it was, where do we go from there? And I have to tell you, I was blogging pretty intensely, probably 3 or 4 days a week during those times. And I said, watch what China's doing. And everybody said, in 2021, the Chinese were going to devalue the yuan in order to make sure that they didn't lose any of their global competitiveness. But it actually went the other way. The Chinese actually appreciated the yuan. The yuan went from about 7.10 down to 6.2. And what were they doing? Stockpiling everything. So as everybody was getting rid of their copper, their grains, the Chinese were buying. And they were buying it with a strengthened currency. So they really were in a commanding place. And that lifted, you can go back and look at them, the depressed commodity stocks, Bunge Grain, Archer Daniel, the mining companies, Freeport, one after another, they Glencore, they were all did very well in that period where everybody was predicting other types of actions. So those are the types of things we try to see. And I'm watching the Chinese, and the currency will tell me a lot. Again, so is yuan? Yuan is caught in a range here. It's moderately weak, but it's not anything that right now tells me they're panicking, because all I do is, and I read enough about China, read a lot about China, and everybody is, they're going to panic because we're going to crush them. And I'd be very careful here. And tomorrow, if the Chinese wanted to take Taiwan, they'll take Taiwan, because the United States isn't coming. And especially during the time of Trump, because Trump doesn't look to go to war. So if I don't accept that, which is the mainstream narrative, where am I going to look and what's the response going to be? Because anytime they want to, as we say, tip over the apple cart, they can. And then we'll see what the outcomes. So always looking to see what I know what the mainstream thinks, but is that going to be the outcome? And if we do this right, we will find better outcomes and better opportunities. That's really what our goal is.
Yeah, the mainstream, what the mainstream thinks is never wrong. It's just not ever very right. And I'll take that back to my emphasis, which is on energy. Just to give you a boring energy example, OPEC, Saudi Arabia, is planning to increase oil production when price of oil is lower than it's been for many, many years. And if you read what the mainstream says is, that's because they're trying to punish the quota cheaters like Kazakhstan. And that is the mainstream view. And I will submit that, yeah, that's part of it, but that's like 1% of the story. I mean, you have to believe Saudi Arabia is stupid if you think that they're shooting themselves in the foot financially to punish one member of OPEC. No, they're not that dumb. So what's really going on here? Well, that's what you want to know, all right, if you're in my business. To your question, Darren, a very penetrating one, no, I don't think there's any possibility that the United States and China will completely separate from one another, because Ira mentioned how dependent Germany is on China. Well, guess what? So is the United States. I mean, you know, most of our medicine and our raw materials or manufactured goods come through. And China can't get, I mean, we're the biggest market in the world. China is dead meat if they can't sell to the United States. All right. So what's happening right now, as Ira said, is a lot of noise. And what you need to do is find the signal in that noise. And the signal in that noise, as far as I can tell, is that the United States wants to put some guardrails on China's expansion, which is reasonable if you're protecting your own people and your own interests. China is a bit out of control, and I agree with Scott Bessent on that, on his statements about how China is the most unbalanced economy in possibly the history of the world. Again, that's not a political statement. That's just an objective fact. And so it's reasonable that you would want to put that in check if you can. And if you can is a big question. But, you know, I look at, are we going to get into a war? And there are many, many ways to get into a war. And, I mean, no one can predict that. But I am much less worried about getting into a hot war than I am about everything else that we're talking about here. Unless there's an accident, which is certainly very possible, I think the probability of a hot war is relatively low between the United States and China. And we, you know, if you decide to work with us, we can tell you, you know, more why we think that. But what's happening right now is posturing and positioning. Nobody knows what the other side is going to do. Nobody knows what the other side wants. Nobody even knows who else is on the other side, other than China and the United States. So there are a million things to talk about and to worry about before we figure out what the outcome of this is. And the final point, going back to what Ira said, is we live in a very complex and nonlinear world. And anyone that offers you a simple and linear solution, well, you know, we're not going to waste our time with them, because that's not the way that we think. That's not the way that we try to position our clients, which doesn't mean that we disrespect people who think that way necessarily. It's just we've been in this business a long time and that never worked. It's never worked for us, let's put it that way. And we're still alive. So, you know, we're going to continue doing things that have worked for us in the past. Leave it there.
Richard, if I can add one. So, Soren, we actually did a couple podcasts with Michael Pettis, Richard and I, and we discussed this. And that's why I watched the currency, because as Art talked about, the imbalances within China, of course, they save more money and invest more money over the years than is healthy in classical economic analysis. So readjusting those imbalances is very important. And if you're looking to enrich your middle class and make them or push them more towards a consumption-based economy, the last thing you want to do is depreciate your currency. That was done to them. You know, the depreciation of the yuan came in 1994. But, you know, and this has been this tells you how the Chinese are always moving to react. And when did they devalued the yuan from 5.8 to 8.7 on January 1st, 1994, 50% depreciation of the yuan. And it also happened to be the day NAFTA started. Coincidence? Hardly. And what were the outcomes? But it took 4, 5, 6 years to really start to see the outcomes. We saw One of the effects was we got Mexico, which was a destination for a lot of foreign direct investment, never really got going because the Chinese stole their thunder. And then in 1997, from July 2nd on to 1998, we saw the Asian contagion, where China was eating everybody's lunch in Asia because they had depreciated the currency and were going after those markets. So those are the types of things we want to delve into and look to see where potentials. Now, did I know on January 1st, 1994? No, but I was certainly aware, because as a currency trader, I said, this is interesting. And I, but I wasn't, you know, as plugged into NAFTA. I knew NAFTA was coming, but things like that, and to see those types of outcomes. And those are really important, because when other people make mistakes through those periods, it's very important. And that brings us to Europe. You know, and Germany is very important here, because Europe has done everything backwards. They created the euro before they created as Christine Lagarde would say, a capital markets union and any type of fiscal harmonization. Totally backwards. You're supposed to put those into place and then have the currency. So they've been chasing that. But I think Europe, and I think this will be a very telltale sign. Lagarde, and in fact, at last week when at the press conference, she had to remind the press to ask that question in the last 3 minutes of the of her press conference. Nobody asked me this question. She is pushing for that capital markets union. I think if we get it, and I think it's a must to get it, by the way, I think it's mandatory for the world financial system. That'll change the entire financial rubric, because now you'll have a euro bond rather than 27 or 19 separate bonds that we call European bonds. And I'll have to work it out. But I think it has to come if Europe is really going to be an alternative source, as they proclaim to want to be. So, I mean, those are the types of things that we're looking, that we will be looking at.
Well, great. Thank you very much to everybody, to Art, to Ira, to the audience participants for the questions and participation. And we'd like to put this also on our website. We'll put the slides there for reference. We'll also have the replay of this podcast. And feel free to contact us anytime on helping you with assessing and mitigating the risks on global political uncertainties. The email address info@cedarportfolio.com. And also, just as a way of a heads up, we have upcoming podcasts that we're doing, many covering global political uncertainties risk. Dr. Mark Farber, Peter Buchvar, Larry McDonald, Craig Shapiro, those are some of the participants for podcast discussions coming up in the near future. Again, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Art.
Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.